Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.
Coming up on Weekend America.
In Ohio, voting's not what it used to be.
They spent an awful lot of money, our taxpayer money, for those machines, for them not to work. We're going backwards instead of forward. Back to paper.
Well, actually, it's exactly what it used to be. I'm Desiree Cooper.
And I'm Bill Radke. Rebuilding a major bridge in sub-zero weather takes a big budget.
There's probably at least $2 million that are just being spent for protection of the workers, for heat, for sheds, for buildings.
Workers in Minneapolis pushed through winter to rebuild the collapsed I-35W bridge. And in North Carolina, low fat means meat that came from the bottom of a pig.
We're cooking up some pork belly and some lard. It's been cured for about 24 hours in just salt and sugar, and we're kind of just crisping it up a little bit.
Eating high on the hog. Coming up after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And I'm Bill Radke, and this weekend I'm at North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC Chapel Hill, and I have been wondering what to eat here. I've heard so much about North Carolina barbecue that it has me wondering, okay, well, what else is there? You can't eat the pig every day, can you? I'll find out later this hour. What else should somebody do when they visit North Carolina?
I would go to the beach and enjoy everything there, especially fishing and sitting in the sun and watching the fish jump out there in the ocean.
I enjoy going to the beach quite a bit. I try to do that as often as I can. It's very relaxing.
You should get outside. Doesn't matter if it's the beach or the mountains. You can get to almost any environment in 3 hours or under.
I love Durham. I try to take advantage of all the good restaurants and maybe go out to streets of South Point.
I would go shopping, go to Charlotte, go everywhere.
I bet there's some North Carolinians who don't like hearing their secrets told, the charms publicized. Those voices are all from Durham, North Carolina.
Well, now we go to Cuyahoga County, Ohio, which includes Cleveland. And there, dozens of poll workers are spending some part of this weekend in training. They're not just getting ready for the expected heavy turnout for the Buckeye State's presidential primary. That's on March 4th. Poll workers are learning about a new system that's just like the old system. In late December, Ohio Secretary of State cast a tie-breaking vote, and now they're scrapping their three-year-old electronic voting machines, and they're going back to paper ballots. Other parts of the country may soon follow suit. From partner station WCPN in Cleveland, Mari Saito reports.
No one really wants to spend part of their weekend in a city hall basement with 19 strangers doing nothing for an hour. But that's just what I found when I walked into such a meeting room recently in Lyndhurst, Ohio, a suburb of Cleveland.
I'm a reporter. They tell me to show up for poll worker training here.
Well, guess nobody.
The instructor never showed up.
The instructor never showed up.
No.
Like others there, 78-year-old Janice Beck came to training to find out if what she'd read in the newspaper was true. That with just weeks to go before the Ohio primary, Cuyahoga County was tossing the electronic voting machines they've been using since 2005.
Now they're going back to the paper, I understand. But, you know, we were trained before the touchstone machines. So now we're going back, so I don't know what to expect now. I thought maybe it would be interesting to know what we are going to do now.
Cuyahoga County's three-year history with electronic voting machines has been interesting more for its mishaps than its successes. Ohio already had a reputation after the 2004 election, after record turnout led to long lines in local precincts. But when electronic voting machines came online in 2005, results were still delayed thanks to lost memory cards and confused poll workers. Then in November of last year, things got bad. Kimberly Hagelberg covers politics for Cleveland Public Radio.
Barely no one shows up at the polls, no lines, everybody gets to vote. 2 hours after the polls close, the servers crash. And I mean, they go down. They freeze completely.
The servers for
tabulating the votes.
It was too much for Ohio's new Secretary of State. The Democrat cast a tie-breaking vote to make Cuyahoga County scrap electronic voting units and newspaper ballots. Now the county is trying to set up 350 classes to train people for the change. Jane Platten is in charge of that effort.
I'd have to tell you, when I went to the training, the trainer forgot to show up.
Oh, my God. Great. They're always, you know what, that's the human element. That's why poll workers are so extremely important to us because they have to be, have to understand the process because the element of human error is, you know, whether you have somebody that doesn't show up or, again, that human error is what is going to, in this system, cause a vote not to be counted.
Are we on page 5 of our poll worker manual?
After I talk to Jane Platten, I head downstairs to catch poll worker training, this time with a trainer.
We have a lot of new changes. I'm asking that everybody hold our questions, our past experiences. We're trying to move forward. We're looking in a new direction. The big thing the Board of Elections this year is focusing on is customer service.
Training with the electronic voting units used to take over 4 hours, and a lot of time was spent on setting up the machines. At this training session, the trainer pulls out 2 battered metal suitcases, one blue and one black.
Now, what I'm going to ask is for 2 volunteers each. I'm going to ask for 2 volunteers for this one pole star. Just go ahead, open it up, and what we call it is like an old Samsonite suitcase.
A couple of people get up, open the cases, and take out metal poles. The poles screw into the base of the suitcases and turn into legs. The case opens up, some side flaps pop in, and the suitcase turns into a rather flimsy-looking voting booth. This is where voters will fill in their ballots. Workers will bring the votes back downtown, where they'll be read by an optical scanner.
And that was it. It took us less than 2 minutes. We got it. It took us less than 2 minutes.
There's something amazingly underwhelming about the lean-to voting machines the class just assembled. One poll worker next to me whispers that they look cheap. 78-year-old poll worker Janice Beck found the electronic voting machines intimidating and is glad to be going back to paper. Still, after she has her training session, she says she feels cheated. Electronic voting machines cost Cuyahoga County $21 million.
And they spend an awful lot of money, our taxpayer money, for those machines. For them not to work, you know, and then so abruptly they had to turn around and go back to, maybe going backwards instead of forward, back to paper.
Ohio's primary is on March 4th. New equipment for that election is estimated to cost $2.5 million. In Cleveland, I'm Mari Saito for Weekend America.
As Ohioans go back to printed ballots, some Americans are moving away from paper to online voting. I'm talking about those Americans who live abroad. In just over a week, expatriate Democrats will vote by mail, fax, in polling places, and, for the first time, over the Internet. The registration deadline is Thursday, and that makes this a very busy weekend for Meredith Gowan-Legoff. She is an expat living in Paris, and she volunteers for the group Democrats Abroad, coordinating the voting in Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. Meredith, welcome to Weekend America.
Bill, thanks for having us.
Why this move to internet voting?
Well, because Democrats Abroad has members in over 100 countries, and so we're spread all around the world. And we were really concerned this year also about our membership being able to get absentee ballots for their state primaries. So we asked ourselves, you know, what is the best way to really expand our reach? And we decided that online balloting would provide us that because it would let, you know, the Peace Corps volunteer in Africa or whoever still connected only by a computer to the United States to participate and not be left out in this important decision of who's going to be the Democratic nominee. Up until 2004, we did caucuses like on the Iowa caucus model, but it favored so much people who lived in large urban areas like Paris and London were huge turnouts in Tokyo or Hong Kong. But you couldn't do that in smaller country areas. It wouldn't be as exciting. But really and truly, the big concern is are the people who are, you know, sort of in isolated areas and their only connection is an internet.
How many people are signing up?
We're having thousands and thousands a day. It's just been amazing, the response to this. Everyone is so fascinated by this election and this process, and the Democrats are all so fired up you know, thinking, well, you know, I can't even get my absentee ballot for a primary. And then all of a sudden they find out about us. And so I think that they're really excited to be a part of the process because we actually send delegates to the Denver convention. So they know that their vote's going to count in Denver.
How can you be confident the vote you cast online won't be hacked or lost to a computer error?
Well, you know, from where I grew up, you know, the dead still vote in Louisiana. I mean, there are lots of things that could potentially go wrong in any election. And, you know, obviously this might be a big challenge to a hacker somewhere. We're hoping that that hacker might care more about democracy than hacking. But not depending on that, you know, we have a lot of processes, and we've also chosen an outside vendor, Everyone Counts, to run the online voting. The best we can do is the same as New Hampshire or Michigan or anywhere else, is to have, you know, the members of our list and correspond that to who actually voted. And another important thing to remember, though, is that our ballots are actually public. So you have to give your name and your address, so it's not secret and it's not anonymous. So it's probably even a little bit easier to catch than, you know, someone in Mississippi going across to Alabama and trying to vote again.
What are some top election issues for expat voters? I know that's a big group, but and in your case, Democrats. What are you hearing as big issues?
Well, I think that, you know, obviously because we live abroad, the image of America and all that's happened in foreign policy is something that we're all, you know, daily aware of the consequences for our country. But the economy, like in the United States as well, is taking precedence over that with the dropping dollar. It affects a lot of our members who are retirees or paid in dollars. Another thing about, you know, why it's so important who the president of the United States is because the consequences just don't stop at the border of the United States.
Meredith, I meet people who talk about bolting from the U.S. and leaving all their American frustrations behind them. Why are you so dedicated to expatriate voting?
No matter where you are, it's our country and you still love your country. And anyone who thinks that just by leaving the United States is leaving it all behind has never lived abroad. Because as Americans, you know, our right to vote is something that is ours, that we keep no matter where we are. And to have a voice and to participate in that is still our civic duty.
What is the biggest difference between following this campaign from Paris versus from the States?
Well, you know, it's funny. It's because, I mean, it's been so long since I've actually been in the States when it was like the heat of a campaign. I think probably my blood pressure doesn't go up as much because I can get a little bit distracted from it, although I go to bed at 10:30 and wake up at 2 to watch the debates.
Meredith, thanks for talking with us from Paris.
Oh, well, thank you, Bill. Thanks for having us on.
That's Meredith Gowan-Legoff. This weekend, she's working on the website and the database for the group Democrats Abroad. She is coordinating the vote in Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. There is a group called Republicans Abroad. It is, however, not affiliated with the Republican Party, so it cannot hold a U.S. presidential primary or caucus. Instead, the group educates expat Republicans on how to register to vote overseas.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
Next on Good News, Bad News, No News, a package of stimulus, some candidate animus, and a snow-going school bus. Stay tuned to Weekend America. This is Weekend America. Desiree Cooper is in St. Paul. I'm Bill Radke, sitting in the shadow of the Lucky Strike Water Tower in the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm at the Durham studios of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It is time to evaluate the week's news in our segment, Good News, Bad News, No News. And joining us today, North Carolina writer Will Blythe. Welcome, Will.
Hey, Bill.
Also, essayist, author David Rakoff. Hi, David.
Hello, Bill.
And Yale literature professor Amy Hungerford. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Bill.
Our first topic, as the economy slows and stock markets wilt, President Bush and congressional leaders have worked out a stimulus package of tax rebates, stipends, and investment incentives. Economists aren't sure it'll make much difference. How does it feel to you? Like good news, bad news, or no news?
I think it's kind of no news. The government has very little power in these extremely complex world markets, and so it's doing what it can. It's also no news that there's always this wrangle about whether it's really worth giving money to poor people. And this is one that I just don't understand. The economic slump has profound effects on people who are really living on the edge. And I think we ought to be frank about saying that relief is needed, not just economic stimulus.
Will?
To me, it's good news for the banks. It's bad news for the Democratic presidential candidates who would love to run against a recession. But I think it's no news because most Americans, if they get these rebates, which sound like they're going to be somewhere between $400 and $800 or so, it seems to me it's just about enough to cover the year's cable bill.
David?
It strikes me as baddish news. Everything that I'm reading seems to indicate, in the natural course of things, by the time the government is intervening on things like this, we've already hit bottom and the economy will start to pick up. But I keep on reading as well that we actually have to sort of kind of suck this up and that this really only prolongs a kind of a weird bubble situation and we actually have to try and sort of lance those boils.
Let's go to our next topic. Some Democratic Party officials are worried about the bickering between Hillary and Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. A new Clinton radio ad accuses Obama of supporting Republican ideas when actually Obama was just saying the Republicans were the party of ideas for a long time. Does the fight feel to you like good news, bad news, or no news?
I think it's no news. I think that it's in the news cycle, but we have a year of this to go. The main thing is this happens every year, which is like we must return to the civility of discourse. Where is this vaunted mythic age of American civility in politics? You know, also, this isn't a bake-off. This is the presidency. So if things get a little dirty and kind of vicious and extreme, that is as it should be. It's an extraordinarily important job. And we're, you know, we are also so far away from anything sort of Atwater or Rove or Swift boaty.
In a certain sense, I think this is worse than the Swift boat version of the attack, because what disappoints me about it is that the Clinton campaign takes nuanced comments by Barack Obama, simplifies them in an idiotic way, and then presents that simplification as Obama's true meaning. And this seems to me just returning to the impulse to demonize the other side, whatever that other side might be. Let's be able to speak in more than one sentence, and let's be able to think in more ways than just, is it good, is it bad? And here
I am
on the hill of good news, bad news, no news.
Oh.
But yet I want to say that.
Okay, our last topic. It snowed about 3 inches last Thursday in Fairfax County, Virginia. A high school senior called a school official at home and left him a message asking why school had not been canceled. The official's wife returned the call.
How dare you call us at home? If you've got a problem with going to school, you do not call somebody's house and complain about it. My husband was up at 4 o'clock this morning trying to decide the best thing to do to send you to school on a day when the weatherman is calling for one thing and another thing happens. You don't begin to know what you're talking about. And don't you ever call here again. My husband has been at the office for 6:30 this morning, so don't you even suggest that he purposely didn't answer his phone. He is out almost every single night of the week at meetings for snotty-nosed little brats. And he may not have called you, but it is not because he's home, because it snowed. Get over it, kid, and go to school. Get an education. That's what you're there for.
The student uploaded that message. It's now all over the internet, along with the school administrator's home phone number. Now he gets lots of calls at home. Is this good news, bad news, or no news?
This is awful.
I don't have a problem with a single word that she said. I'm completely on her side, to the point that I've actually had a complete Kinsey shift while sitting here listening to it, and I'm completely straight now.
Yeah, and I also think that people need to learn, children especially, need to learn how to respond appropriately when someone doesn't respond appropriately to you. And this child could have easily made that recording known to the superintendent or somebody else who would have had an appropriate kind of private or relatively private response, so that whatever issues are at stake here about access and free speech could be addressed, but without making this woman's tirade the property of the public sphere. It's just inappropriate.
Well, maybe they're about free speech and transparency. Look, this woman said what she thinks. Now we all know what she thinks. How do you know you're not all just old and cranky?
If it had been about transparency, he would have included his own message to her. Instead, you just get him basically, you know, hanging her out to dry.
And wasn't there also an amusing quote in the newspaper article where one of the other students, also a senior, said something like, "They just wanted us to go to school so they could spend another day stuffing our heads with knowledge."
Oh, it's awful.
It's just fantastic.
Wasn't it kind of good news to hear some good old-fashioned grown-up outrage?
Yeah, I like the fact that she wasn't treating students like precious veal calves. It wasn't that sort of, you know, uber politeness now that a lot of people, adults are afraid of children, I think, in a way. And so that's what I liked. I like seeing her getting a good whack.
A verbal spanking.
No, it was minty and refreshing. I liked it.
Okay, that's the news this week. Panel, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
That's Yale literature professor Amy Hungerford. David Rakoff's latest essay collection is called Don't Get Too Comfortable. Will Blythe is the author of To Hate Like This Is to Be Happy Forever, a thoroughly obsessive, intermittently uplifting, and occasionally unbiased account of the Duke-North Carolina basketball rivalry.
Well, Valentine's Day is right around the corner. Don't forget to get something for your boo. You know, your little schmooky-wooky. As Valentine's Day nears, we're thinking about those terms of endearment that we have for our spouses, our siblings, babies, or co-hosts like Billy McBilly. We're wondering, what's your special phrase for your honeydew?
Could be a pet name, a movie line, a song lyric, a code phrase. My wife and I have an entire language. We want to hear about your special words and the story behind them. Go to our website, tell us your story, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
Man and dog heed the call of the wild. Join us for the Bear Grease Sled Dog Marathon, coming up on Weekend America.
Thank you.
From American Public Media, this is the show about what America is doing this weekend. I'm Bill Radke. This weekend, I'm at North Carolina Public Radio.
And I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota. Right now, you might be relaxing, but there's a crew of workers hammering away at the new I-35W bridge in Minneapolis. It's been almost 6 months since the bridge collapsed, and crews have been working for about 3.5 months nearly around the clock. They want to open a new bridge by Christmas Eve. Now, 24-hour work crews, that's nothing new, but in the dead of winter in Minnesota, this week, actual temperatures dipped as low as minus 17 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, I visited the site to check on the progress a few days ago when it was a balmy 6 degrees. There's these big, it looks like airplane hangars out here with scaffolding inside. And there's also tarps covering some wooden structures where they'll probably be pouring the cement. I'm going to go down there and check it out.
My name is Robert Edwards, and I am the assistant project manager for the Flatiron Manson Joint Venture. What we're doing out here is the design rebuild of the I-35W bridge.
So, Bob, will you show us how you keep warm out there?
Be glad to take you on a tour. Okay, so what we're looking at here is one of the casting beds that we're going to use to cast the segments. And so this is one that they're just starting to frame and get the side forms up on. And they're going to pour the base and the walls. And then after that's poured on these, they'll form up for the what is going to be the roadway.
Oh, it's freezing. It's like my eyeballs are starting to hurt.
Yeah, you'll start to cry. So we'll head over here and take a look at some of the heating sheds that we have here.
Keep on going, you're all right.
So is this better?
This is much better. I mean, my knees were starting to get cold, and I sort of felt the tip of my nose getting numb.
So you don't
quickly.
Have multiple layers of
I have
of
two
pants
layers.
On.
I have long johns on under here.
That's good. That's good. But you can see how much more pleasant it would be to work in here than to work outside in the wind.
Yes.
And this is what we're trying to do, not only because we need to keep the concrete warm, but it makes our workers safer and more productive.
It's amazing to me that you can conserve enough heat to really heat up a structure this big.
Hey, my name's Tracy Hay, and I'm a superintendent in the precast yard.
You're starting your shift before the sun is up, and you're ending it after it's down. So in those hours before sunup and sundown, is there something different that people do?
Well, generally, they get started a little slower. But I think everybody kind of starts out a little slow in the morning, right? And you know, we have our safety meeting, we have our stretch and flex.
What's a stretch and flex?
First we do squats, and then we reach for the sky and stretch, and then we'll stretch left and right, and then we'll stretch our wrists and our fingers. Pretty much just kind of limber up a little bit before we get going.
How you doing?
Hi. I'm Desiree Cooper. We're with Weekend America.
Okay, very good. My name's Rick Peterson. I'm a carpenter.
Okay. So do you typically work through the winter?
Yes.
As a carpenter?
Yes. Yes. Weather, it does become an issue. I mean, we layer ourselves out. Myself, I've got about 4 layers of shirt and a jacket.
But you're not even zipped up. Your mother would be upset.
Oh, no. Work hard, stay warm. You get cold, we have the availability to go into a building like this here and get warmed up.
Where's your beard?
Finlander, we don't have a whole lot of facial hair.
Well, Rick, I'm losing feeling in my toes, so I think we should keep walking. Nice
Not
to meet you.
Thank you.
Bob, is there ever a moment where you're saying it's just too cold and you just call off work for the day?
Certainly. We did it last weekend when we had our severe minus temperatures and a heavy wind, and our wind chill was down minus 35, minus 40. We've also had, in the last couple of nights, crews go home. We don't dictate that. They do. If they say it's too cold, then we're going home.
Bob, thanks for showing us around.
Thank you. I'm glad you came out to see us.
And I look forward to driving over this bridge next Christmas Eve.
Well, and I hope you don't stay away that long. As we make different progress and it warms up, we'd be glad to have you back again.
There are tours of the site every Saturday, rain or shine. They begin in the parking lot of Grandma's Saloon at 11 a.m. Follow the bridge's progress. Go to our website at weekendamerica.org. We'll be right back.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
This is the radio show about the weekend. Desiree Cooper is in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I'm Bill Radke. I'm visiting Chapel Hill, Durham this weekend, thanks to my hosts, North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. And now we're going to Texas. Ever since mysterious objects were seen in the skies over Stephenville, Texas, earlier this month, UFO investigators, news media, and the plain old curious have descended on this town of almost 17,000. And weekends in Stephenville are transformed. Restaurants are more crowded, and when you go to Fiddle Creek Steakhouse, you'll see strange, unexplainable things on the bar menu.
Here at Fiddle Creek Steakhouse, you can get the exclusive alien secretion shot. It's a fruity drink. It's 3/4 Malibu, 3/4 shot of melon or Midori, a 1/2 ounce of sweet and sour, and a 1/2 ounce of pineapple juice.
That's kitchen manager Joshua Flick. His alien secretion shot is not the only thing that has changed in Stephenville.
Okay, I have noticed a lot of little things, like the kids are running around with their tinfoil hats on. They don't want the aliens to read their minds. I guess they got off one of the movies or something. The businesses, they're just trying to cash in off the tourism. It's just cute little signs like a UFO parking in the rear and UFOs welcome.
Well, in our marquee, we put up UFO parking out back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you do not want the aliens reading your mind. Trust me. Gary Warren works at Chicken Express in Stephenville. He's the guy behind those UFO parking signs.
Just to kind of add to the ambiance of all the sightings and all the talk about town. Let's see, UFO sighting early in January. I've noticed quite an increase in traffic, people coming to investigate. Most of the people that have had the sighting, we've known for quite a while. They're very credible people. So I have a tendency to believe that they did see something. I'm not sure what it was, and I'm sure they're not sure what it was. And I think that's why we call it a UFO. For Stephenville, anytime you can get in the spotlight, it's good for us. We've always been known as the cowboy capital of the world. Now I guess we'll be known as the UFO cowboy capital of the world.
Crystal Gilkey, and I'm at Jake and Dorothy's Cafe. The weekends have been busier since the sighting. This last weekend, we were actually had our busiest day this year, I think, as far as 2008. And it's usually slow in January, so it was actually pretty good for us. There's just been a lot of hype around it. There's a place in town, Barefoot Athletics, is selling T-shirts.
Once word got out that we were selling these shirts, then we had lots of visitors from the state of Washington, Alabama, just all over the United States have actually been in. My name is Matt Shaw. I work at Barefoot Athletics in Stephenville, Texas. It's been kind of a windfall for our business. We screen print T-shirts, so it's been pretty exciting. They're black with kind of fluorescent lime green ink, and we're known as the cowboy capital of the world, so we put that and then crossed out the word cowboy, and then put UFO capital of the world with an alien, what we assume an alien looks like, and a cowboy hat on.
Perhaps the biggest change to weekends in Stephenville is what people now do to pass their leisure time.
This weekend, I'll be looking up in the sky, watching out for the UFOs.
Mm-hmm. That's Joshua Flick again from the Fiddlehead Steakhouse. Good luck, Stephenville. Keep the tinfoil on.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Desiree Cooper here with Bill Radke. The John Bear Grease Sled Dog Marathon commemorates the son of a Chippewa chief. John Bear Grease delivered mail by dog sled along Lake Superior's rugged North Shore in the late 19th century. The Bear Grease Sled Dog Marathon was launched in 1981, and it draws world-class sled dog teams from all around the globe. It's the longest and most challenging of sled dog events in the lower 48. It starts in Duluth, Minnesota on the last weekend of January and goes almost 400 miles along Minnesota's North Shore line. 4,000 spectators attend. Field recordist Kurt Olson gathered some sounds of the dogs, the mushers, and the fans at the Bear Grease in years past.
Start of track show, Alex, on the third race trail. My first of all, marathon competitors here today.
Welcome to the North was.
Yeah, how you doing?
Look good. He's even got the Rudolph dog up front with a flashing red blinker.
These dogs are just in great shape, and we've got a fantastically groomed trail. The conditions really couldn't be better. It's a pretty rigorous race, and test both the musher and the dogs. More of the musher, I think.
Well, there's a lot of good teams here. I'd be real happy if I finished in the top half.
It is a big deal, and it's a long race. I mean, it's 390 miles. Serious race.
Drifter.
All right, he's doing running well?
Yep.
When we're checking the dogs, we do a pretty good orthopedic exam and check all their bones and joints. We listen to their heart and just a quick physical exam to make sure there's nothing else going on with them. We check out the toes for any splits or anything like that that happens when they're running, little cracks in the pole pads, and just have a good look around, basically.
All right,
Drifter,
you're
back into the
water. Dogs! Dogs! I thought I saw dogs.
Yep.
Oh, lots of dogs!
Two more teams.
All right, on across. All right.
That's it, on across.
Good guy.
That's good.
Thank you very much for your help. One of the mushers, Nancy Yoshida, said she came around the corner and all of a sudden was staring at the back end of a moose. And the moose turned around and came right at her, ran right down the middle of her gang line through the dogs, took one step inside of her sled bag and then up over the handlebars and ran away. She dove off the sled and then got back up, and she said it was a big bull moose and a close encounter. And two other mushers ran into that.
Whoa. I guess I turned left. I gotta go across that trail, huh?
Yes.
That's the trail enough.
Okay.
I didn't see that little snowboard trail. I turned left on the
okay.
Same trail. That's
fine. Have a good run.
Straight ahead.
Straight ahead. Keep. There you go. Good boy.
1-8. Of any checkpoint, there's about an hour that's just devoted to taking care of the dogs. So a 2-hour rest turns into really a 1-hour sleep. But if you stay for 6 hours, you get a 5-hour sleep. Then again, if you don't play it right and you do blow a checkpoint, your dogs are tired and you could lose a lot of time.
Jennifer Dye from Finland, Minnesota. Let's hear it.
They're pretty ungrouped. I didn't push them at all. They had to pace themselves, and they just got more and more confident and wanted to take Ziggy, but Tia got a little bit sore, so I had to take Ivan. And Ivan's kind of a clown. He likes girls, and he likes to eat and dip in the snow and roll around and play a lot. And I thought he was just too young and goofy. He was just incredible. He was just 100% there the whole way. So it was great.
Good boy.
That trip to the Bear Grease Sled Dog Race was produced by Kurt Olson for the public radio website hearingvoices.com. You can see the dogs competing in their little booties. Just go to our website at weekendamerica.org.
Well, I'm at North Carolina Public Radio today, not far from this weekend's Krispy Kreme Challenge in Raleigh. Run 2 miles, eat a dozen donuts, run 2 more miles.
Mm.
The forecast is for clouds and sunshine, mid-40s and nausea. And now here is John Moe's take on the weekend weather.
Kansas turns 148 this week, not the band, the state. And North Newton is throwing a rustic, old-timey party with corn shelling, log hewing, spoon making, and all sorts of activities that 19th century Kansans never expected would be regarded as fun. Cloudy and 45 with at least a partial chance of dust in the wind. Wayward sons are advised to carry on. When it comes to sandwiches, everyone talks about the meat or bread, but little regard is given to the importance of lettuce, the offensive lineman of the sandwich. Yuma, Arizona comes through at Yuma Lettuce Days with lettuce boxcar derby, salad toss-off, and food booths, the food being lettuce, and live entertainment, which is also lettuce. If you're going to be in Northeast Ohio, are a fan of presidents slain by anarchists, enjoy snow in 33, and are looking for a party, good news. Canton holds William McKinley Day, honoring the 25th president with Civil War reenactors, planetarium shows, and a Meet the President talk. Admission is half price if you defeat William Jennings Bryan in consecutive elections. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
You're in North Carolina, you know you're supposed to eat barbecue, yet something inside you rebels. That's next on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by LendingTree, helping customers find the fixed-rate loan that's right for them. You can choose from up to 4 offers today, 1-800-555-TREE or at LendingTree.com. When banks compete, you win.
Desiree Cooper is in St. Paul. I'm Bill Radke at North Carolina Public Radio this weekend, courtesy of my hosts, WUNC Chapel Hill. And when I asked locals where I should eat while I'm here, I kept hearing about barbecue, of course, and one barbecue spot in particular.
Hello.
Hi, Keith.
Yes, sir.
Bill Radke from Weekend America.
Yeah, Bill. How are you today?
I'm Keith Allen runs Allen & Son Barbecue. It's just north of Chapel Hill. And we talked about how he spends every day in a wood-fired pork barbecue pit. And I asked him, so do you ever get tired of that? What do you eat when you have got to take a break from the pig?
Salads.
Really?
Well, I do. I stay.
Please tell me you're a vegetarian. That would be awesome.
No, I'm not a vegetarian, okay. But I stay in front of a fire all the time, and so really cool food seems more refreshing to me than a lot of hot foods.
Okay, well, that's fine. I like salad too, but I can get that in Los Angeles. I wanted to know if I lived here in North Carolina, and I wanted something besides barbecue, what would I do? So I met up with local food writer Kelly Alexander. Hi, Kelly. Nice to meet you.
Hi, Bill. Nice to meet you.
Tell us about where we are.
We are at Three Cups Coffee Shop in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And we're here because I think when people associate, think about the South and Southern food, they automatically first think of barbecue, fried chicken, biscuits. But really what we have in our town is an amazing coffee shop that has great fair trade imported coffee. This shop in particular specializes in coffee, chocolate, and wine, are definitely not what you'd expect, and pretty far cry from barbecue.
There's a wall of chocolate here with there's no sign saying, Bill, take this home to your wife. But I guess they didn't feel they needed to say it, to come out and say it.
I think it probably sells itself in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, right next door is a fabulous sandwich shop, and it's basically the anti-barbecue. He serves things like lamb tagine sandwiches and my personal favorite, prosciutto with gorgonzola butter. So let's go next door and see what's going on in sandwich, and you can find some serious non-barbecue enthusiasts.
Hi, we're doing a food tour of North Carolina. May I ask what you're eating?
Right now I'm eating an outrageous BLT from Sandwich.
This is the OBLT I've heard about.
Yes.
And what makes it O?
It has avocado and jalapenos on top of the regular BLT.
That's outrageous. That is transgressive in so many ways. What about North Carolina barbecue?
It's a question of what is the constituent element in the sauce? Is the barbecue sliced or is it chopped? What are the side dishes? And people get, as they say locally, right ugly about it.
And what do you get right ugly about when it comes to barbecue?
Well,
what makes you right ugly, if I may ask? Because you're a good-looking man.
Well, there are the Texas pretenders, and the issue becomes one of what is the meat, whether it's pork or beef. And here it's pork, period. This isn't even an item for discussion. Whereas in Texas, it's a little more slippery.
So you're saying North Carolinians are genuine and you just call everyone in Texas a punk?
That's your interpretation. I have to be careful about such things. You're free to make that, draw that conclusion if you want to.
What's your personal favorite? Are you a barbecue guy or something else?
Well, my doctor tells me no. But once
you're no longer a barbecue guy.
No longer a barbecue guy, but once in a while I may try something.
So now we're going to take a quick walk a couple of blocks up the street here on Franklin Street in Chapel Hill to Lantern Restaurant, a great Asian restaurant in town. Again, probably not what you'd expect to find in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
So this will be a good refuge from barbecue for me?
Definitely, although what you will find on the menu is a lot of great local pork. One of the great advantages of a restaurant like Lantern in a town like Chapel Hill is that the chef can have a relationship with area farmers. This chef in particular has farmers who give her special cuts of pork and who allow her to come on the farm and get exactly what she needs. It's about as close as a farm-to-table connection as a restaurant can have these days.
Great, let's go.
Hi. I've got the lard on.
The lard is on. Andrea, this is Bill Radke.
Hey,
this is Andrea Roosting, chef and owner of Lantern Restaurant.
Andrea, great meeting you.
Nice to meet you. How's it going?
Great. What are you cooking up?
We're cooking up some pork belly and some lard. It's been cured for about 24 hours in just salt and sugar, and we're kind of just crisping it up a little bit.
Let's listen to the pork belly. How do you describe your cuisine?
Our cuisine reigns supreme. A little Iron Chef joke there. No, our cuisine, well, is based on food from all over Asia. You know, if we're doing a Thai dish, we kind of stick to all ingredients that would maybe occur in Thailand. Or if we're substituting something, it would be a local ingredient that grew usually within 25 miles or 50 miles of Chapel Hill. So we're trying to do food from Asia, but with a lot of local ingredients from North Carolina.
How much barbecue do you eat, Andrea?
I wish I ate more. I mean, the reason I wish I ate more is in North Carolina, we produce a lot of the nation's pork. And there's actually something like only a 3-day food supply in state for the number of pigs that we actually grow in state, because we're just bringing so much corn feed into North Carolina all the time. And so for that system to change, the rest of the country has to stop eating so much pork. And everybody has to grow pork where they are.
So I often kind of feel like for every barbecue stand, there needs to be a small, sustainable, integrated family farm right next to that barbecue stand to kind of supply that barbecue stand. And then that should be the kind of like limit of the pork that we should be able to eat. And so if there was a barbecue stand next to a farm in North Carolina, I'd be eating a lot more of it.
So when you're in North Carolina and you just told a national radio audience to eat less pork, how do you get home at that point? Back streets? Or?
Here, you guys want some?
Oh, I'm not good at describing food. I'm just good at enjoying it, which I am. Delicious.
Oh, thanks.
And you'll find that recipe for Lantern Restaurant's pork belly laque with pickled green tomatoes at weekendamerica.org. Kelly Alexander there. She teaches food writing at Duke. I also discovered a North Carolina delicacy this week, imported from Mexico, called Loco Pops, cream and water-based popsicles with flavors like cardamom and ginger and Mexican chocolate, and I think it's going to explode. Oh, I ate well this week. And that's another hour, well-fed hour of Weekend America. Our special thanks to the entire wonderful staff of North Carolina Public Radio. Also, thanks to photographers Kit Larson and Gary Mines. Our show's produced with Ben Adair, Julia Barton, Neely Allel, Millie Jefferson, Sam Keenan, Michael Rayfield, Susie Lechtenberg, E. Okobie, and Tim Bamba.
Also, Johnny Vince Evans, Chrissy Clark, Brendan Noonan, Shirley Shin, Phyllis Owens, Angela Kim, John Moe, and Mark Sanchez.
Our theme music was created by Galactic. Executive producers Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show. You can get a free podcast at weekendamerica.org. I'm Bill Radke, headed out to get some pork shoulder this weekend.
Oh, bring some for me. I'm Desiree
Done.
Cooper. Get out there and enjoy your weekend.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Hi, I'm Desiree Cooper, co-host of Weekend America. The weekends are for freedom.
Our job is to liberate them from the sensibilities and the conventions of their day-to-day life.
Now I just walk down the street and I'm like Mary Poppins. I'm free as a bird.
Forget the chores, the errands, and the weekend runaround. Liberate yourself with Weekend America, where great radio lives on the weekend.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.